listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Sterling.
And I am Paul Strolley.
And you're listening to State of the Arts.
Here on the magic that is LA Talk Radio.
That's correct. And yes. We'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, Paul Breakdown Services, for supporting us this year. Breakdown Services is the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit them at BreakdownExpress.com. And happy holidays to Gary Marsh and the entire Breakdown family.
Our thanks also goes out to PerformingArtsLive.com for their support of our live arts calendar. Performing Arts Live is the most comprehensive online directory of event information for music, theater, and dance events in Southern California. We also wish Performing Arts Live founder Mike Napoli, fellow Paisan,
yes,
and his staff a wonderful holiday.
Indeed. And Paul, coming up in just a few minutes, we'll be talking to James Rodet, who's with us in studio today.
From Psych.
Yes, James, of course, is best known as Sean Spencer in the USA TV Network's original series Psych.
And in studio with us today, another fine young actor from television stage, Brad Rader, who with James Rodet founded the Red Dog Squadron Theater Company, now residing in Los Angeles. We'll be talking to James and Brad about their careers and Red Dog's West Coast premiere of Greedy, opening at the El Centro Theater in Hollywood January 8th, which really looks good.
And it sounds fantastic. Fantastically interesting.
So let's welcome the two gentlemen who are here. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
You can speak. You can say
okay.
The pleasure is ours.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Is it?
I'm sure I'm not the first one to say this, but I will confirm that this room is indeed full of magic.
And that's only because it's Pantsless Monday.
It is a magical pantless place.
Which we don't normally tell people
that's true.
Because you can't really see
it. But one of our dresses, one of our guests has already disrobed to some extent.
Yes, he does. We want people to be comfortable.
He has shed his shoes.
I'm not done.
You're not done.
My scarf. I still have a hat.
Was it kind of one piece at a time?
What kind of party is this?
Really?
I've heard about these Hollywood types.
You guys know a Mike Napoli who doesn't catch for the Angels.
Yes, correct. That's right. Unless you're speaking in euphemisms.
No. you have your own Mike Napoli.
There you go. Yes, this one I wouldn't suspect he would be that
player. I don't think he catches for the Angels, metaphorically.
Yeah, no.
I don't think he does.
Paul, how was your week?
My week was magical, Michael.
It was.
It was great. And I made my famous limoncello. My family recipe of the limoncello and drank it and saw dragons. It's grain alcohol and milk and sugar and lemon rind, and it's a 100-year-old recipe, and it's very popular.
And it's a family recipe, 100 years old?
Yes, if your family is the Manson family, it's a family recipe, yes. Yes.
Wow.
No, but I was thinking about something. How was your week, by the way?
We're in a busy season, so like everybody else, trying to get it all done, you know, the shopping and the rain complicates everything, doesn't it? I mean, you boys are from the East Coast, so you see how crazy Californians are, right? In driving, they have no respect for anybody whatsoever, and rain or shine, quite, you know,
I tell you, I'm looking at this and watching the people on the news, and it's raining. It's in Los Angeles, and it's raining.
Yeah.
And then back East, this would be Thursday. You know, it's just like it's raining, people. It's not acid, falling from the sky.
In Los Angeles, I mean, if it rains, people think of a way not to go to work. You don't do it. You can't function. It's a whole other mentality out here.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of disrespectful driving, I've noticed.
On the news, Saturday night, is it, you know, if you don't have to do anything tomorrow, try to stay at home.
It's
raining.
It's true. People are just generally confused.
That's it.
But for us, it's really fortuitous because in this play that we're doing, there are torrential rains, and it's been raining for a really long time.
Oh, really?
And
the houses in the play have leaks, and because it's been raining, the rehearsal space we've been using has leaks.
Oh,
rehearsal.
That is lucky.
The weather is very serendipitous for us.
That is lucky. But it doesn't feel holiday-like when you're out here. Because, I mean, there's no sense of the passage of time. There's no snow.
Well,
so I have actually taken a step on that point,
yes,
if I could. We were talking to Malcolm McDowell. We had Malcolm McDowell on the show last week. And he was talking about doing a reading of A Child's Christmas in Wales.
Mm-hmm.
So in honor of that, I thought I would prepare a little piece called The Nightmare Before Martha about my attempt and A Martha Stewart Christmas.
All right.
I would like to read it. Gentlemen, if I could impose on you two to at least begin humming Silent Night, to give some sort of background, if you would, one or the other, if you would. And then I'll fade you out.
Ooh, in harmony.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and in the light of my taper, I was pounding papyrus to make homemade paper. I can do it, I thought, as I sat stuffing pheasants. I'll go pure Martha Stewart. I'll make all the presents. The first thing to do was a gingerbread house with caramelized windows and a marshmallow mouse. But as I melted the sugar and made graham cracker shingles, I scalded my hand on a candied Kris Kringle. I had a crystal decanter that was chock full of brandy for the doorknobs and shutters that would be made of candy. But the bottle exploded from the heat of the stove. Jack Frost did a facelift and nipped off my nose. Now the dough was ruined as I bled in the batter, and it was just about then that the mixing bowl shattered. It cracked down the side, the syrup did leak, as I pulled bits of crystal from my now shredded cheek. Though hardly discouraged, I assembled my house, smiling, who needs the windows and screw the damn mouse? Though a candy cane fence made with cinnamon sticks made it look like the carolers were turning some tricks. The roof broke in half as it started to settle. It was Frank Lloyd Wrong meets Hansel and Gretel. My gingerbread house was a crystal meth shed, the home of Snow White and the Seven Crackheads. It was hardly a house, but it wasn't a failure. I had created the world's first gingerbread trailer. So I embraced the challenge and then, without haste, carved a whole white trash family from marzipan paste. Tiny underwear hanging from a clothesline of string and a 3-year-old donut made a nice tire swing. In the front yard was Martha, awaiting her guests, with twin cracker babies on each of her breasts. My Martha nativity had quite hit the skids, with her cigarette dangling and her buttload of kids. I hung on some lights and set it out on the porch, but the light shorted out and the whole thing got torched. I cannot describe all the warmth that I felt as Martha and family all started to melt. My heart was so full that it started to sing. It felt just like Christmas, and that's a good thing. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you.
Well,
thank you. Really good.
Was it as magical for you?
Really.
Are we allowed to pick favorite parts?
Yes, you certainly can.
I like the carolers becoming hookers.
The carolers becoming hookers?
Yeah. We all look for that.
I also saw a little knowing wink on the cracker babies hanging off Martha's
One
breast.
From each nip.
Yes.
That's...
Very sensitive poetry,
yeah.
Right, Paul.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Indeed.
All right, let's kick off the real show, shall we?
Indeed. Absolutely. As promised today, ladies and gentlemen, with us in studio is actor James Rodet, star of Psych, a detective comedy drama television series which airs Wednesdays at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time, and in which James portrays Sean Spencer, a young crime consultant whose heightened observational skills and impressive detective instincts allow him to convince people that he solves cases with psychic abilities. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. James Rodet.
Felt a little light.
Do that again? Got better?
Yeah.
Oh. Huh? And the drop-off is so natural.
I understand. There's a lot. The weather is not kind, and we did the best that we could.
Yeah, there aren't a lot of people here, whole weather thing. So, first of all, James, I want to say thank you to all of us who do live theater in Los Angeles, and when people who have established themselves on television come back and do live theater, it's always great because it calls attention to live theater, which in L.A. needs all the help it can get in terms of attendance, and it's such a different dynamic here. I know you two are... from New York, it's completely different getting people out to the theater in Los Angeles because it's not a cab thing, it's not a let's meet at a restaurant thing. Everyone has to drive after driving their whole other, the rest of their lives. So we're very grateful and thank you for being part of that.
Couldn't agree more, so I won't try.
Okay, so first question, Red Dog Squadron, how was the name arrived at? You can both sort of field this one if you'd like.
Well, we were producing a show in 2001, and we thought we were very clever because the show had two guys and two girls, so we just picked our girlfriends to be in the show with us. It was Sexual Perversity in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
Dammit.
Well, you'd know about that, Paul, right?
What?
You'd know about that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
A little bit. Yeah.
This was our first production as a formed company here in Los Angeles.
Okay. Although we didn't have a name yet, so we were rehearsing and things were going well. But it came time to start promoting the show.
Ah.
And we decided to look no further than the actual text itself of the play to to find our company name.
Which we felt would have meaning since it was the first show we were doing.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And
I don't remember sexual perversity that well. That term is used.
Well, in the very first scene, Bernie, who I was playing, is regaling an episode to Danny, who James was playing, about an episode he had the night before with a young lady. And, you know, she's making him do all kinds of things and, you know, making airplane noises. And she calls up a friend and she's, you know, pretending like she's in a fighter pilot. And at one point she says, Red Dog 1 to Red Dog Squadron. And James and I looked at each other and said, that's it.
Stop the presses. I don't even think we need to do the rest of the show.
Yeah.
We're just going to do the opening scene. And as soon as you say Red Dog Squadron, lights out.
That's it.
And now with each subsequent show that you do, you change the name of the company to be something included in the first speech, right?
That's right. And we're about to do our second production of Sexual Perversity in Chicago. So we're going back to the Red Dog Squadron.
Well, we didn't really set that up at the beginning of the show about Red Dog, but I'm glad we're talking about it. And as Paul kind of alluded, James, I mean, you're a celebrity now on television, and what it's done for, do you feel it's done for the company, what you had hoped that it would do, actually? You're 6 years on a popular television
series.
Yeah,
it was actually when you gave
USA.
Me that very kind intro, one of the things that occurred to me was that if the show runs for too much longer, they're going to have to take Young out of a description of my character.
You know, I actually watched I watched an episode this morning.
He's a crime consultant.
Yes.
He was a young crime consultant.
Yes. Now a one-time young crime consultant. Yeah.
Former young crime consultant. I'm sorry, Michael.
No. I caught a little bit of an episode. I wanted to see it this morning to have it fresh in my mind. And you're very charming and very... I mean, the whole take on the show is very light. And yet it's a comedy drama, of course.
Is. But... it's been a wonderful blessing. I mean, we sort of come out here and it's a grind, and you do what you can do, and a lot of times you end up working on stuff that you know isn't very good, but you know, you always convince yourself that it's a means to an end so that something like Psych will someday happen to you. And it did. It happened to me. So it's a good story, and it's a good story to tell other actors that, you know, if you stay the course, then, you know, it can happen, because it was one of those projects where the planets just aligned, and it was good material and good people on the right network, and you kind of have to have all of those ingredients to have any shot at success.
Of course.
And we did, and the rest, as they say, is history.
And you shoot the show in Vancouver, or I know it's set in Santa Barbara, but you shoot it in Vancouver,
is that
right?
We shoot it in Vancouver, which I believe David E. Kelly coined as Boston, California. That's where we shoot.
I mean, you do a lot of the master shots of Santa Barbara for that reason in Santa Barbara.
That's true. And here's a little bit of irony, and I'm sure you guys are both big fans of that word and all of its misuses.
You don't mean coincidental.
No. This past, what was it, this November, I guess right after we wrapped this season, we went on a little college tour, and the last stop of the college tour was UCSB. And that stop marked the first time in 5 seasons that anyone from our show had set foot in Santa Barbara.
Actually set
really?
Foot in Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I guess we have stock sort of exteriors that we use that we never actually went there to shoot. Yeah, we really whiffed on the on the authenticity there.
But, I mean, so many shows are doing that, right?
It's true. It's true. But to answer your question... yes, I could not possibly hope for more for Red Dog than what Psych has provided. Not only because you know, we can sort of piggyback the show and the network's website and the Facebook fan sites and all that stuff to help promote our shows, but also because the turnout for our shows from Psych fans has been tremendous. They travel from far away distances.
Oh, really?
To come and...
And you're able to use that architecture for your live theater and promote things through that?
I have. We have, shamelessly, yes.
Mm. Oh, that's what it's about.
Hey, absolutely.
But,
absolutely.
You know, a lot of these kids who are fans of Psych have never seen theater. And so, you know, we're giving them an opportunity to kind of experience that for the first time, which is a real joy.
We found that with our company. I have a company here in town called Sea Glass Theater, and we're in our third year. And one of the first production we did, one of the guys on our board of directors is James Denton, who's on Desperate Housewives. He plays the Mike the Plumber on that, the Terry Hatcher love interest. And the first show that we did was called How Sissy Grew, and it was exactly that same scenario. People that you would not, you know, you would not expect to attend theater or had not attended theater were there, and more importantly, digging it and then bringing other people. That's the thing. So you can get them on the hook with the TV celebrity and get them to come in. And then, you know, but they have to enjoy the process enough to want to tell friends about it, because that's what it's about. So
I figure we're averaging one psych cast member per play, which will get us through about two or three more shows, and hopefully by then we will have built up enough of a following that we can do a show without anyone.
And at which point you will have written Psych the Musical to be the
next.
Well, Maggie Lawson is your girl, isn't she? In real life, and she's also in the show.
She is. Yeah? She is this show's psych representative.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Awesome. How is that working with your girlfriend on the stage now?
Well, she, as Brad can attest, she's fantastic.
Right.
I've worked with her as a director on Psych, mm-hmm. but never before on stage. And what I'm discovering is that it's more gratifying because we have more time,
mm-hmm.
you know. And you know, she's a terrific actress. She makes adjustments on the fly. She's great, and she's really, really invested in this show because it's an opportunity for her to show something really, really different. You know, she's been on the show for 5 years, and everyone sort of identifies her now as that character. And this is about as far from what she does on the show as you can get. So she's really jazzed about it.
She's doing some great stuff. We play siblings in the play, and it's just a joy to work with her.
How many people in the cast?
We have 5 characters, but 6 actors, because for the first time in our history, we have double cast a role.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
You say that with some sort of a little wink.
Well, you know, we weren't sure what it was going to bring, but
now we know.
Now
it's
we know.
Twice as much rehearsal.
It was.
This game is a surprise.
You know, double casting roles has always been intriguing to me. Since I saw, you know, the way Circle and the Square did True West a few years back, sort of kickstarted the idea that when you do True West, both guys get to play both roles.
Right.
So since then, I've sort of there's always been a seed of, you know, can we do a play where people change roles or we have more than one person playing a role? And this was sort of our litmus test for that.
We toyed with it in Sexual Perversity.
We did.
And we talked about it for exactly 30 seconds because we realized how difficult it would be.
Well, that Sexual Perversity wouldn't be too difficult. I want to see a double cast of Mice and Men. I want to see Lenny and George swap it out.
That would be good. But no, we have two tremendous actors playing one character, and they're very different,
mm-hmm.
and their takes on the role are very different, and it's been a really interesting process.
All right, so Peter McKenzie will play the role on Thursdays and Fridays, and then Kurt Fuller will play the roles on Saturday and Sunday.
It's got to keep the actors on their toes, though.
It's got to be
real, real juiced. You know, the actors have to be very juiced for something like that. I would dig that because, you know, you don't get sedentary. You don't get locked into any. I mean, granted, this is what, a 6-week run?
It's a 4-week limited engagement.
Yes, it's a little less than 6 weeks. Yeah.
It's a 6-week run abbreviated.
Yeah.
Yes. Like I worked in a deli, and a woman used to come in all the time and ask for a small quart of milk. So I guess we have that. It's called a pint.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the 4-week limited engagement. Okay, yeah. So no risk of becoming sedentary in 4
right.
weeks. It'll still crackle.
It was necessary because of everyone's schedules and, you know, coordinating people who are working in television and who do have crazy lives. You know, it turned into 4 weeks, but I think it'll pack a punch.
Yeah. Well, it looks like it.
You know, James, you have your roots, both of your roots are in the theater, of course, and you've done a lot of theater and then transitioning. Did you move out here specifically to do television and film?
It was a television job that moved me here. One of the few deals I made with myself coming out of college was that I would wait for a job to move me to Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
which I think a lot of people tell themselves that.
Yeah.
And then many, many, many years later, they're still waiting for that job. I just got lucky. I got flat-out balls lucky. and about a year after graduation, I ended up on a short-lived TV series, but it shot here, so.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
It was called Ryan Caulfield Year One, and as you can imagine, the critics had a lot of fun with that title, once it didn't come out very well.
What a prophetic title.
Yeah, it was ambitious. But then, you know, it seemed every time something wouldn't work, I would make the plan to pack up and move back to New York, and then something else that wouldn't work would come up that kept me here. And that was sort of the run that I was on for a while. And Psych, it was the quick fun story about Psych is that I'd reached my limit with a third failed television series. I went to Louisiana to do a movie and decided while I was there that as soon as I got back, I was packing up and I was moving back to New York, and I didn't have a plan except that I guess I would rent an apartment. And the Psych script was waiting for me when I got back from Louisiana, and I said, nope, I'm done. I told you I was done. And my agent, who had always been so understanding and so patient with me over the years, laid down the law for like the first time ever and said, no, you will read this script. Real Genius is your favorite movie, and therefore you will read this script. So I read it and changed my plan again, and I'm glad that I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was some waffling when you were close, though. I remember we had played racquetball one morning, and you were really close to Psych, and you're like, buddy, I don't know, you know, should I do this thing? I was like, yes, you should. I think everyone kind of saw how great it was going to be.
Saw how it would fit,
except for the once and future star of the show.
Mm. It was a good fit.
But there are no accidents, though, right?
Actor and role.
There's no accidents in life. Everything happens for a reason. So you were meant to play this part, and you do it well.
And I'm meant to finish the treatment that I've been writing, because now I'm inspired. I've actually been working on a TV pilot called Ryan Caulfield Syndication. really, I'm going to finish that now.
You should.
What's also amazing to me about what Psych has become, especially for James, is a platform, you know, from which he can exercise all of the other hats that he's so good at, writing, producing, directing, and he's really become a fantastic director, and that translates to the stage as well. We're really lucky that, you know, he's got the time and the energy to direct this one, because it's going to be fantastic.
It's funny that you mention that, because that's one of the things we've noticed on this show, because we have people on, and we people on that are known, you know, nationwide for one particular thing, and then through this we get to find out, you know, or ask them about things that, you know, they're not going to be asked about on, you know, Hollywood Now or whatever the current, you know, TV equivalent is. So it's nice of you to say that, and it's nice, we feel good about hopefully being able to shine a little bit of light.
I promised James that I would say that.
Yeah. So I noticed that you're reading from Post-its, but I didn't want to say anything. But thank you for keeping the crinkle factor down.
He's also got $50 in his pocket that he can spend on anything he wants.
Really? Really?
These are two friends who really like each other. Yeah. I like that.
Okay, it's a Ralph's gift card, but the intention is there.
Hey, you got to eat.
That's right. It all tastes the same going down, doesn't it? Paul, we have an arts calendar that we have to address.
Yes, we do, before we get back to this, yes.
And this is a very special edition, gentlemen, of our arts calendar. Usually we're promoting theater and performing arts in Los Angeles and other parts of the country at this particular juncture of the show, but we have a very dear friend in radio in Los Angeles by the name of Julio Martinez with KPFK Radio, and he is a tremendous gentleman who's always been very kind and very supportive of the arts everywhere.
Yes.
In Los Angeles, and a stringer for Variety for many years, and he's just a wonderful, wonderful critic and radio host of his own show called Arts in Review. So, Paul, why don't you tell us?
I certainly will. This is also a field that I love too, the radio drama, which I think is just, you know, or not necessarily drama, but just radio plays. Once again, we're talking about Dylan Thomas and Under Milkwood, a play for voices last week, and I just think I love this style of theater. But KPFK, Pacifica Radio for Southern California, presents our good friend Julio Martinez's Arts in Review holiday special, airing this Wednesday, December 22nd, from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock p.m. Presented annually since 1993, this special broadcast features Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales and the premiere of the radio drama The Nutcracker's Journey, featuring the Arts and Review repertory players. The Nutcracker's Journey, written by Julio Martinez, directed by Irene Aranga, and produced by Mark Torres, features an ensemble of accomplished actors and musicians. The Arts and Review holiday special will also air nationally over the Pacifica Radio Network on Saturday, December 25th, Christmas. And as a gift to all of us, they were very nice to supply us with this, the Arts and Review repertory here is a sampling of what you can expect when the special premieres this week.
The reluctant composer retreated to his apartment with Alexandre Dumas' tome in hand. But it was with an air of mischief that Tchaikovsky enjoyed his coffee the next morning with fellow composer Mili Balakirev.
Mili, Veselovsky wants a theater full of buttocks, no matter what the music sounds like, and I'm going to give it to him.
And just how do you propose to do that?
By making it sweeter than the 6 lumps of sugar you put in your coffee every morning. Mili, I promise you I'm going to give Ivan a ballet with so many syrupy, melodic sweeps. Our esteemed director will be inflicted with gout.
Well, since you're approaching this commission with your tongue planted firmly in your cheek, would you like to make the task a bit more interesting?
How interesting?
A wager. I bet you 100 rubles you cannot write a major theme for this ballet based only on the notes of the octave in sequence. Your basic do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do.
So once again, ladies and gentlemen, tune in to the Arts in Review holiday special on KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM here in Los Angeles, Wednesday, December 22nd, between 2 and 3 p.m. Pacific Time. Or, for further information, call 818-648-6128. Or visit kpfk.org.
Now, before we get back to talking to Brad on the second half of our hour here, Michael, I wanted to ask you about the show that you saw this week that you're going to mention a little bit about.
Yes, absolutely. I'm delighted to do this. Gentlemen, I don't know whether you're aware of this in Los Angeles, but we have a rather famous chorus of singers here in Los Angeles, which is the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles. And they have been in season for 32 years in this city, and they
I auditioned for them.
Oh, you did?
Yes, yes.
I didn't know that.
I did. I didn't know you had to audition for the gay part. That was the only thing that I really wasn't prepared for. Talk about an audition.
I see.
That was a tough one.
You probably went into the wrong building.
Yeah, Murray Raincoat. You know that guy? Same guy?
Well, dark? We've all had a Murray in our lives.
We all have a Murray. I'm sorry. Yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go on.
No, not at all.
Belittling the gay men's
chorus. Not at all. There is no way you can possibly belittle these guys because they are phenomenal. And this was a weekend of performances of their annual Christmas extravaganza called Comfort and Joy, and which was historically marked, I might add, by the U.S. Senate vote of 65-31 on Saturday to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, defeating a 17-year policy of banning gay and lesbian service members from serving openly in the military. So I think that was pretty awesome and a great place to be with an amazing energy, as you can imagine. 151 voices standing on that stage. And Broadway's Cheryl Lee Ralph from Dreamgirls was the special guest with her unique vocals and slick sense of humor and made a complete compliment to the evening. And I must shout out to a couple of people here, Gay Men's Chorus Executive Director, the extraordinary Hywell Sims, guest conductor Dr. Timothy Seelig, an amazing artist in his own right, producer Bill Bowersock, choreographers Billy Rue, Michelle Benton, and Mark Chung, and pianist Michael Alfera, who happens to be a friend of mine, and Sterling's upstairs at Patello's and has often played with us there. And standout numbers, The 12 Days of Christmas by Leslie Brickus, with new lyrics written by Phil Hedema, a black light puppet spectacular conceived, designed, and staged by Phil Hedema. It was amazing.
And you described that, Michael. You were talking about that because, I mean, I think people hear about this and they think, okay, you know, the chorus, it's just going to be a bunch of guys standing on a stage.
Not at all.
But you said it was spectacular.
It was. There was nothing short of that word involved in this production. And the closing of the show, which was probably my most favorite part, a very emotionally riveting rendition of the traditional holiday carol Silent Night, which the three of us were singing at the beginning of this show, was performed by the chorus vocally, followed by a second rendition right at the end of that vocal of it in sign language and in complete silence. An entire theater of 1,500 people, you could have heard a pin drop for a minute and a half, 2 minutes, and it was, it closed the show.
Oh, wow.
It closed the show.
It must have been
unbelievable.
It's brought the place down.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a brilliant idea. The Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles is truly one of the most distinguished choral groups in the country, as I said earlier, and they should be seen. They should be heard by everyone, young and old alike, and as often as possible. And ladies and gentlemen, treat yourself the next time that you learn of a concert of theirs, and you can do that by going to their website, gmcla.org. I urge you to see this amazing group of men supported by an amazing organization. So,
well, that about wraps up. Thank you, Michael. That about wraps up the arts calendar. So for more information about the arts in Los Angeles and throughout Southern California, please visit performingartslive.com. And as always, you can visit us online at stateoftheartsla.com. Michael, would you be kind enough to introduce our next guest?
I would be. Yes, I would be. Now,
I happen to know that he's a stage, television, and film actor who, with James Rodet, founded the Red Dog Squadron Theater Company.
You're
I believe it was following their successful off-Broadway mounting of Henry V at the Mazur Theater in
New
York?
Yes, in New York.
Do I have this right?
You do. And the pair then moved to Los Angeles, where Red Dog's inaugural production was David Mamet's Sexual Perversity in Chicago, which we discussed earlier, but this one took place at the Stella Adler Studio Theater. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Brad Rader.
Okay.
Mine is a little longer. What? A little longer than
yours. Yeah, but see, the thing is, the big difference is that you get three.
Oh, nice. So. I really appreciate it. I'm really lucky.
But there's really no need to stand and bow. I didn't think that was necessary.
Oh, well deserved.
Yeah. Especially without the pants.
Especially without the pants. Sorry.
Brad, welcome. You are from New York, and you were in the new New York University Circle in the Square and Experimental Theater Wing.
Mm-hmm.
You're an alumni there, right?
Yes, yeah.
And your New York theater credits, which I'm reading here, are impressive. Henry V, which was the show, I think, that you did
that we
on establishing the company, right?
Yeah, we were looking for a lead of that, and we didn't have to look further than
right?
the two of us. James was in L.A., so it really, there was no choice.
Now, do you say Henry V, or are you hip enough to say Henry V?
At the time, we were pretty hip, and we thought Henry V was very clever.
But that was back when you were young.
Right. Now, in our older age, we might say Henry V or King Henry V, as Shakespeare intended.
So, James left a year before you.
Yes.
And you hung back in New York.
I hung back, tried to make some things happen. You know, we were always kind of the mind to generate our own work, and we're really interested and inspired by other actors who also produced and directed and wrote their own material.
Luckily, I had written Henry V, so we had...
when he finally broke it out, and I read it, I was really impressed.
Really?
I mean, I knew that he wrote, but I thought it was just kind of limited to the horror genre. this was really good.
Oh, so this is Henry the Serial Killer.
Yes. Right. So I hung back, did Henry V. And unlike James, a TV show didn't bring me out to L.A. It was basically James's couch that brought me out to Los Angeles.
Okay.
A year later.
Well, how lucky are you, that you had a good couch to come out to?
Very, very lucky.
Yeah?
Yes.
A good depth. It was a sleeper couch.
Yeah, listen, not everybody.
And they said you were a fool to dream.
No.
Only a few stains. I still don't know what those stains were.
And strategically placed.
Don't ask, don't tell.
That's right.
So now James told us about a little bit about Red Squadron, but I'm interested in the play itself. This one that you're doing. Great. I don't mean to jump around.
Not at all.
But if you could give us a little breakdown, synopsis, as much as you can tell us about that. I read a little bit of it, but I'm sure you'll be a lot more eloquent in describing it.
Greedy by Carl Gajusek.
Glad you said that, not me.
Yeah. Carl is actually a quite accomplished writer. He had a play off Broadway last year called FUBAR.
Mm-hmm.
And, he writes for stage and for film and for television.
And it's internet radio, so you can say what that stands for. There's no FCC. It's internet radio.
Oh, nice.
Say whatever you like. Yes, FUBAR has especially those in the military, they know what FUBAR stands for.
FUBAR, I believe, stands for Fucked Up beyond all recognition.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, the F word. At Christmas. Yeah. There you go.
Now that I know we can curse, it's a whole.
It was
new
in context, game. Though. It was a descriptive title, Michael. It's not like
children. We have children that are listening.
Well, it was just.
Oh, I'm teasing. Sorry. I'm kidding you. No. The kids are sitting.
Why
right
is Brad
here.
Flipping you off? I don't think that's necessary.
I don't know. He liked me when he first came here today. I don't know.
I'm sorry.
So go ahead, please. Yes.
So Fubar was the play that he wrote.
That he wrote. That was off Broadway last year, and you know, we had been kind of sifting through a lot of submissions,
which was a new experience for us.
Yeah, we were really lucky to get some nice attention from Extinction, a play that James starred in with Michael Weston, both here in Los Angeles at the end of last year, and then off Broadway at the beginning of this year. So, you know, in addition to wanting to find something as good as mm-hmm. Extinction was, we were also lucky to have people sending us stuff. And we kind of threw the net a lot wider. And, you know, we still haven't gone through all of the submissions. So it'll probably last us well into next year.
Now, was that unsolicited, the submissions? Or was that something you put on the website, like if you have an original piece?
Yeah, okay. A little bit of both. Greedy came to us from a friend, another writer, named Alex Litvak, who is good buddies with Carl, and said, you know, get in contact with Carl. And Carl sent us, I think, three plays, and in his first email he said, you know, looking at your past productions and what you guys are about, I think you'll dig Greedy. And we did. We both immediately responded to it.
Well, and I mean, the essence of the storyline, give us a little bit of that, exactly what people can expect when they come to see the show.
Yeah, James.
Do you remember those Nigerian email scams?
Right. Yes.
It's basically predicated on a Russian version of that, and you have a pair of siblings, a brother and sister, who are estranged and have a very complicated relationship, to say the least. Trying to pull off one of these scams on a doctor who they sort of randomly picked based on a photograph that they found on the internet where he was smiling for the camera and shaking a man's hand. And so that made him target. And that man is married to a Bosnian refugee. And so you have the stuff that's happening in that household. And then the fifth and final character is Brad's character's wife, who really, really, really does not get along with his sister.
Okay.
And that's basically the setup for the play. And then, you know, the characters are sort of woven together pretty seamlessly, and it ultimately ends up asking you the question of who in this play is greedy and who isn't greedy and who did you think was greedy, who may not turn out to be greedy, and why. And it gets dark because that's what we generally tend to do. We tend to get dark, and it's just it's a really well crafted play.
Really rich characters, great dialogue,
and it's a fascinating phenomenon too. Because when you think, I mean, it's first of all, it's something that, you know, didn't exist 10 years ago, mm-hmm. and the whole idea of these very educated, you know, people that can allow themselves to get completely taken. I know I've seen, as we all have, the little clips on, you know, CBS News Sunday Morning or Dateline or something like that, and you just see these people and these, I don't know your play, so I don't mean to say that it's like this. It's just my experience with it, but that you see these people that you could be a friend of your family, could be your uncle, could be your sister, that get completely embroiled in this stuff, and how much of it is just basic greed, mm-hmm. and how much of it is, you know, the need to feel part of something, the
That's
need
right.
to join something, the need to feel as though maybe you're helping, companionship, loneliness, all of these different things come into play there, and it's fascinating that, you know, that people can really, not only fascinating that people can be taken like this, but it's also a special kind of deceit where you just totally have to disregard feelings, and you know, it's the great modern day con.
That's absolutely,
you know?
Right. Yeah.
Just
you are all over this thing like
Am I?
You're just nailing it.
Man. Am I?
Just knocking it out of the park.
I mean,
right
I don't mean to.
Thematically, you're all over our jocks right now.
All over our Johnsons.
Well, starting to feel a little uncomfortable.
Imagine how I'll feel about it when I go see it, because I haven't seen it yet. But it just it no, well, but it's
you
right.
Actually, you don't need to see it at this point. You've got it. Congratulations.
Thanks for describing the whole thing, Chuckles, for trying to sell tickets here. Thank you.
I would also add there's an element of, you know, how much of this is self-sabotage. Somebody who knows that this is wrong for them.
Yeah.
And yet he still goes down this path. And kind of the fountainhead, you know, from which these needs come. You know, why does someone feel like they need to be a part of something? Or why do they feel like they need more money, someone who has plenty of money? Or, you know, relationships that come about and kind of become the definition of someone. You know,
right.
What kind of, where they get their self-worth. All of these things are circling the thematic elements in the play.
And a baby.
And there's a baby.
There's a baby.
Yeah, if you'll notice our poster artwork.
Yes, so I saw that baby.
Yeah. Very confused yet stoic baby.
Oh, yeah.
And
With Greedy on his forehead.
With Greedy on her forehead.
Yes.
The child factors heavily into the proceedings as well.
It's great artwork. Who did your design?
A great graphic artist named Bill Strecker in Vermont helped us out with that. And we had a wonderful photographer named Sabina Padilla. And we also had a baby. That baby actually exists.
Oh, really?
Is a beautiful, gorgeous child.
Whose baby is it?
Yeah. A close friend of the company's. Yeah.
It's great artwork because it's so economical, because we're so assaulted by, especially on the internet, assaulted by images and all this. And it's always, and everyone puts in too much, and they think that, well, you know, if you know, 100 words on a poster are twice as good as 50, you know. And so it's nice to see something so clean and so
thank you.
No, it's very, very well put together.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we've really tried to do interesting poster artwork because, you know, James and I grew up collecting movie posters with, you know, stuff all over our bedroom walls, and the, you know, iconography of that stuff really kind of sticks with you. If you see something that really is striking, it's kind of the first time that, you know, you're introduced to a piece of work, whether it's a film or a play.
Speaking of that, CBS Sunday Morning, CBS News Sunday Morning, this past Sunday, did a whole thing on book jackets, on dust jackets, and how much time and energy goes into that, and the shouting shouting factor of books as you walk into a bookstore. It's just, that's basically what they're doing. They're screaming, you know, "Buy me," and sometimes whispering "Buy me" is more effective.
Right.
Visual vocabulary.
Yeah.
Yeah, dialogue.
I stole the Amadeus poster from the train station in Stamford when I was 19. And it was one of those big on the real thick cardboard, and it was just the one where he's got his arms up in the tri-corner hat, and it's just all black, and it's just the eyes and the hands up, and it's
a great poster.
Oh, it was phenomenal. Just, you know, on the top of my Chevy Ventura, driving that thing home.
Hey guys, I need to ask you, and Paul, you too actually, because you're such a good actor, and you're very passionate, the two of you talking about what you just what you're preparing for to open here. And do you have these conversations with regard to the work that you do in television and film? I mean, are you as passionate about it? I'm trying to establish, I mean, when to me, you see, I mean, there's nothing like the theater. I mean, that's where it all begins and ends for me. And yet, what brings, you know, celebrity to someone, of course, is what you're doing on television. It's a whole different animal. You have to work differently. You have to be so skilled in a whole nother way to be able to give a performance like you would in the theater stage in front of a camera and 40 people watching you do it, who are all technically involved in some distracting way, perhaps. But what do you expound on that, if you will?
I certainly appreciate my job, and I am certainly passionate about it, but I don't know. I think if you reduce it to its lowest common denominator, I would say that, you know, we make theater in Los Angeles, which is about one of the most thankless things that you can do, and we do it for no money. And that kind of tells you everything, you know?
Right.
That's the love of the game. It's where we started, and it's where we'll probably end. You nailed it, you know? And There's just no substitute. You can't get there. You just can't get it in television or on film. It
It's too immediate.
It is.
It's too, yeah.
And there's no sense of, there's no real sense of adventure, you know? You always have a safety net. You always have a parachute. You always have whatever you need to make the best possible version that you can do with two or three pages on that given day. It's hard. It's hard for a movie or a television show to take on a life of its own because there's just so much micromanaging and there's so many cooks in the kitchen. And there's so many factors and it's just nothing like the curtain going up and whatever happens for the next 2.5 hours is what happens.
It's
because,
true.
Yeah, because it's preserved. A television film is preserved. A theater is not. It's like what happens in that room on that particular evening will only be shared by those people.
And yeah. It's...
And it'll never be identical, and it'll never be the same thing.
And you just can't get that experience anywhere else.
Even though the actors, you know, have somewhat of a better idea of what's going to happen, you really are in the same exact position as the audience, both artists on stage and the audience in the house have really no idea what's going to happen next.
Well,
and it's organic and it's visceral, and there's no substitute for that live experience.
Well, I'm excited to see it.
It's one more reason why people, especially those listening to our program, Paul, I say this with such earnest, go out and see the arts. Go out and see what it is, the art of your choice, whether it's theater or dance, or something, but feed your heart and feed your soul, because, I mean, there's nothing like it, right?
And not only that, but also if there are a lot of actors in town, and if you are an actor in town and if you've worked live theater in Los Angeles, go see a play. Because one of the things that I always get up in people's faces about, they're like, well, we're doing this play and no one's attending. And I said, well, how many plays have you attended in the last year? You know, and it really is important. You know, doing theater in Los Angeles and wanting good audiences means going out to see other theater companies.
I saw a play last night.
Did you?
At the Hudson Theater, yes, I did.
Good for you. Okay, what was the name of it?
I saw the closing night performance of Bob's Holiday Office Party.
There you go.
Yes.
And did you enjoy it?
I did. It's a crazy, zany, wacky show. I guess they've been doing it for 15 years.
Well, that's awesome. And we need to tell people
I
how...
Am, and can, is it okay if I
absolutely.
Do?
Absolutely.
Performances
Please
of
do.
Greedy take place Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays and Sundays, January 8th through 29th. All performances begin at 8 p.m. There'll be two preview performances on January 6th and 7th at 8. General admission is $20. The El Centro Theater is located at 804 El Centro Avenue in Hollywood, 90038. For reservations and information, go to www.reddogsquadron.com. That's www.reddogsquadron.com. We got a couple of minutes left. Can we think we got time?
Yeah, we have to. We have
Gentlemen,
to make the time.
We baptize all of our guests by having them relate their most humiliating onstage story. Do any of them leap readily into your collective or individual memories?
The wheels are turning, the eyes are getting big here.
It doesn't
over
necessarily
here,
have to
Brad.
Be on stage. It can be any sort of performance-related thing where catastrophe, on-stage catastrophe,
mine
embarrassing.
Mine goes back to high school.
You're on.
Yeah.
They're
Go
always
ahead.
The best.
Doing a production of Hamilton Dean's Dracula, which is not the Bram Stoker version.
He made sausage, too, didn't
yes,
he?
Yes. I was playing Jonathan Harker, who is Lucy's young lover.
Yes.
I believe Keanu Reeves played him in the Francis Ford Coppola film.
Well, Keanu Reeves had the role.
Yes,
Let's
he did.
Just say that.
Yes, he did. The end of the first act is Lucy has fainted because she's been bitten, and we don't know that yet. And I pick her up off the couch, and I'm going to carry her up to her room. And as I turn, Dracula, the Count, appears at the base of the stairs. And it's shocking. And then the curtains close, and that's the end of your first act. And I will never forget this, but one night I turned. I had her in my arms, the train of her dress got under my foot. I turned, there was Dracula. I fell, she went flying, and his presence really had an effect that night on us. And then the curtains closed. I end up spraining my knee. Luckily, she was unharmed, but she was certainly surprised. And I limped my way through the rest of that run.
You see? Nothing like it, right?
That's it.
The theater.
True.
You're
story.
Next, Brad.
I don't know if I can top that, but it also involves the sprinting. It was
you were doing Dracula, and someone was carrying you off stage and dropped you.
I was Dracula.
You.
Okay. No. It was a production of The Tempest at NYU. That's where James and I met. And we were in rehearsal for The Tempest, and I was playing... what was I playing? Trinculo. And it was this very, very innocent move. I had to basically hop from one foot to the other, and I just was sloppy and sprained my ankle right there and then in rehearsal. And I was on crutches for weeks. And luckily, you know, my opening night, I had a slight limp, but it was just completely pointless. And it was the worst way to sprain an ankle.
What was the name of the character you said?
It was Trinculo.
Oh, I thought you said Tinkerbell. And I
no, that was another production.
That was another. Yeah. Okay.
Tinkerbell is definitely up there.
He sprained his wand.
There you go. Well, guys, what a treat to have you both on the show, James, Brad. Thank you so much for joining us, especially in this particular week of the year, a busy week for everybody,
our
a holiday
pleasure.
Week.
Treat for us. And I'm going to write a short story called The Tremendous Gentleman, based on your description of Julio.
Well, there you go. Thank you. He thanks you.
I'm sure he does.
And to all of you listening out there, next week we will have in studio with us Ryan Eggold and Jillian Zinser, stars of the WB's hit series Beverly Hills 90210. And they will be joining us to talk about their careers and the world premiere of Amy and Elliot, written and directed by Ryan Eggold, opening of the Stella Adler Gilbert stage in Hollywood January 7th through the 30th.
And to take us out, here's our friend Anthony Field singing once again this week from his new CD with Chip Smith, You and Me on Christmas Eve, available at iTunes, CD Baby, Amazon, and Napster. Thank you, gentlemen. We're going to let Anthony play us off the air.
Thanks, guys.
I've been all around the world at every time of year, but once I spent Christmas with you, girl, one thing was very clear. You could be walking on the Great Wall of China, I could be sitting near the pine in Carolina. Nothing is better to me than you and me on Christmas Eve. And you could be tanning on the beaches of Bermuda, I could be smoking cigars down in Cuba. But nothing is nicer, you'll see, than you and me on Christmas Eve. And I hope you'll make a promise.
You're listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.